It's November 29th. You're listening to the Humanist Network News, an audio production by the Institute for Humanist Studies. I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
I think we need a little disclaimer on this month's program.
Yeah, I suppose you're right, Duncan. As we promised, this month's show is about sex.
This month's show is brought to you by the letters S-E-X.
Making whoopee.
The horizontal hokey pokey we'll be discussing.
Knocking the boots.
Penning your teller, as they say.
So if you're as uncomfortable as I am right now, you're going to want to go ahead and just press stop and tune into us next month.
Oh, we'll be discussing 1001 recipes for happy human gingerbread cookies.
And as you can tell, since we're obviously not mature enough to handle this topic,
I don't think I'm mature
enough. All hour long, we've sought some experts.
We did. We have a sex therapist.
Yep. We've got humanist advice columnist Sweet Reason.
Mm-hmm. We're going to be reviewing a sexually explicit film, Short Bus.
We've got our comic artist who has recently gotten some flack over one of his more graphic works.
Pornographic.
Yes.
Cartoons, cartoon breasts, and sexual activity.
And if that's enough to push you over the edge, tell them what else we have, Duncan.
Ah, we have a radio production for you, Masterpiece Theater Audio. Sexually explicit, however, and we will warn you before that segment airs. So, you know, is there an age limit on this show, Jess? Like, maybe people who are below a certain age, they might want to turn off the...
I think that's one of the topics that we hope to sort of cover tonight. But parents, if you're out there with your children, use your own judgment. Say, Duncan, what is the humanist position on sex? Is it anything like the missionary position?
No, it's much more fun than that, Jess. Humanism is a non-religious philosophy based on reason and compassion. It's not a religion. There's no dogma or set doctrines. Instead, we draw our ethics and we choose to act based on a foundation of ethics and reason and compassion. So when we approach sex, it's no different than any other topic. This is a part of human nature. It's a part of humanity.
And so we're living ethically and we're just making decisions based on our morals and our values and the consequences of our actions?
Absolutely. There's nothing inherently wrong. We don't see anything inherently wrong or evil with sex. We don't believe in sin, so therefore we don't believe sex is a sin, unlike... Many fundamentalist religious views.
Even sex for things other than procreation?
Well, there's two types of sex, aren't there? Maybe even more, but there's sex for procreation, sex for pleasure. Sex can be a very deep emotional bond between two people as well. We also believe that, some of the more politically charged issues involving sex are comprehensive sex education, as opposed to faith-based, abstinence-only dogma.
And women's reproductive health?
Women's reproductive health, women's reproductive freedom.
Yep. Sexuality?
That's right. Gay rights, lesbian. Your right to be sexual in whatever way you choose, so long as you're not harming others. Or breaking any laws, that's right. Well, Jess, we could talk about sex for the entire show ourselves. I mean, it's all we ever do in the office anyway, right?
Pretty much.
But we might as well turn to the expert on this.
I guess you're right, Duncan.
So who's our expert guest on sex?
Dr. Ronnie Klein, who is a sociologist, licensed marriage and family therapist, and a certified sex therapist, which he has been for 26 years. His entire career has been aimed towards one single set of goals, which is telling the truth about sexuality, helping people feel sexually adequate and powerful, and supporting the healthy sexual expression and exploration of women and men. Marty Klein has been honored by both the California Association of Marriage and Family Therapists and the Society for the Scientific Study of Sexuality. He's been an expert witness or consultant in several historic federal anti-censorship trials, and for 6 years, he's written and published the monthly blog Sexual Intelligence.
Oh, which our Humanist Network News e-zine readers are familiar with because we syndicate many of those columns by Marty in the H&N e-zine.
Marty lives in Northern California with his wife, cactus garden, and enormous collection of rock and roll albums. He's the author of 6 books. His most recent is America's War on Sex.
Yeah, America's War on Sex, The Attack on Law, Lust, and Liberty. America's War on Sex takes an in-depth look at the religious right and their irrational attack on human sexuality. So, you know, those attacks include, or some of the questions that Dr. Klein addresses is, why are our government and the religious right censoring Comedy Central, the internet, HBO, and your public library, giving taxpayers' money directly to religious institutions, legislating good moral values, eliminating strip clubs, swing clubs, and adult bookstores across the country, limiting your access to contraception, brainwashing your kids that God hates premarital sex and that it ruins lives.
All that sounds pretty good to me. I wish I knew the answers.
We spoke with Marty by phone this Monday.
Dr. Marty Klein, you are a licensed marriage and family counselor as well as a sex therapist. Now, one could imagine what a sex therapist is, but could you clarify a little bit or expound on what a sex therapist is?
A sex therapist is a clinician, usually a psychologist, who has some background in various aspects of sexuality, the medical side, the historical side, anthropology, sociology. And a sex therapist helps people deal with sexual problems, whether they are more functional, such as orgasm difficulties or erection difficulties, or more psychological, such as guilt, shame, anxiety, and of course that includes couples problems as well, such as desire discrepancies or too much conflict.
Dr. Klein, our listeners are very familiar with your monthly e-zine, Sexual Intelligence, in which you tackle issues of political issues, cultural issues relating to sex. And one of your recent articles was about the Mark Foley scandal. And I was wondering if you could explain your perspective on this. Basically, we had a Republican congressman who was scandalized by sending sexual emails to a young page. And it's my understanding that the conservatives were claiming, well, everyone's telling us we need to tolerate homosexuals, and so this is what happens. Now we have a pedophile in the midst. Is that your impression of what was being claimed by the conservative right? And what is your take on the situation?
Well, your question does a good job of expressing the extraordinary intellectual confusion and dishonesty of the Republican and religious right around not only this issue, but around most issues like this. Homosexuals are not pedophiles any more than heterosexuals are pedophiles. I mean, it's two entirely different issues. What the religious right and the Republican conservatives in this country did about the Mark Foley issue was to say that this shows that sexuality itself is the problem. That when you get adults having strong sexual feelings, that sooner or later there's going to be problems, whether it's problems with young adults or problems with disease or problems with infidelity or some darn thing like that. Sexuality is not the problem. You know, bad sexual decision-making is the problem, and obviously this guy who had very poor judgment and very poor impulse control. Whether he expressed his poor judgment and poor impulse control with teenagers at all, whether the teenagers were male or female, whether this was in private or public, it's still the same issue. You know, the issue here is poor impulse control and poor decision-making and the willingness to exploit other people, whether they're male or female or teenagers or adults.
So essentially what you're saying is, you know, Mark Foley is not a pedophile for having sexual desires for a 16-year-old boy. It's simply that he shouldn't be acting on those urges.
Well, first of all, a pedophile is not someone who's interested in a 16-year-old. Mm-hmm. You can marry 16-year-olds, so we can hardly say that a person who has sexual fantasies or sexual interest in 16-year-olds is a pedophile.
Uh-huh.
And that said, we all have sexual fantasies about inappropriate partners. We all have sexual fantasies about people or activities or situations that are not appropriate, but the glory of the human imagination is that we're able to not only imagine but enjoy imagining a whole range of things. So it's very important that that we not demonize people just because of the thoughts that they have. The problem with Mark Foley is not that he imagined how fabulous it would be to have erotic contact with 16-year-old guys. It's that he actually acted on those fantasies.
We're all familiar with the baggage that religion can bring into a relationship. What are the issues that you see with the non-religious clients that you have?
Well, if you grow up in Western culture these days, you grow up with baggage about sexuality, the idea that sexuality is dangerous, the idea that sexuality is this powerful, irrational force that will sooner or later cause mischief if it's not tightly controlled. Certainly in Western culture, especially in America, you grow up with a certain amount of misinformation or ignorance about the human body and about the nature of human sexuality. I mean, we have all these college-educated people in the United States who actually did think that Mark Foley was a pedophile. We have all these college-educated people in the United States who don't exactly understand how a woman's menstrual period works.
Right.
We have all these people in the United States, and Canada for that matter, who don't know exactly what the deal is with contraception and birth control. So you don't have to be religious in North America in order to be confused or misinformed or ignorant or anxious about sexuality.
I'm very interested in monogamy and sort of the traditional ideas of a relationship, especially a sexually active relationship. Dr. Klein, is monogamy a natural state for human beings to be in a relationship?
Well, first of all, nobody knows what a natural state for a human being is. We haven't lived in a natural state for 20,000 years. The second we put on shoes, we're not living in a natural state. And the second that we plug an appliance into the wall and listen to a podcast or a broadcast or check our email, we're not living natural lives in any way, shape, or form. And I don't know that any of us wants to live a natural life. I mean, how many of us want to live without the pasteurization process in our milk? So I don't even get involved in what's natural or not natural. You know, as Katharine Hepburn said in the famous Humphrey Bogart film, The African Queen, human nature is what we're here to rise above. So I don't get involved with arguments about what's natural. I mean, the institution of marriage is very new in the 150,000 year history of human beings. The institution of marriage has only been with us for a few thousand years. So, you know, it, from an evolutionary point of view, you know, that's the wink of an eye. So I don't get involved in what's natural. You know, what I'm more interested in is what fits the values of the people involved in the institution, what fits the values of the way we want to live today. I don't know that social justice is a natural human phenomenon. My understanding is that, you know, 50,000 years ago, the big guys clubbed the little guys, and, you know, that's not the way we say we want to live right now.
Mm-hmm.
So the way we want to live right now has a strong social justice component. It has a strong component of people wanting a certain kind of personal satisfaction. It has a component of people wanting to establish lives based on relationships that are meaningful to them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's another brand new idea, by the way. 500 years ago, people didn't go around, or for that matter, 200 years ago, people didn't go around marrying somebody they loved. People went around marrying out of economic and political necessity. 200-300 years ago, people didn't have families that were based on equality and reassurance and all of that. The family itself was merely an economic unit. And, you know, to talk about some traditional marriage is to just dramatically misread human history.
Mm. I think that Duncan's looking for permission, Dr. Klein.
Well, and we live in a culture where people can't simply say that. You know, we live in a culture where it's very difficult for people to say, "Honey, I love you until the end of time, and I want to devote myself to you emotionally. I just don't want to be sexually exclusive." It's very difficult for people in North America today to look someone in the eye and say that without having some dreadful repercussions. And so what most people do is they just do what they want and they hide what they're doing, you know, which is not a very good solution, although it's the most common solution. The other thing that people do with monogamy is that they are, in fact, sexually exclusive, but they're resentful or they're resigned to a life that they don't really want.
Do you find in your marriage counseling and in your sex therapy work that a lot of married couples put their sex lives on hold while they're raising children? And what kinds of work are you doing to help those people if you do, in fact, encounter that?
Well, of course, people's lives change radically when they have children. And those changes sometimes involve sex and sometimes don't. You know, our economic lives change dramatically. Our social lives change dramatically. The amount of sleep that we get changes dramatically. The way that we look at our own bodies changes dramatically. So I think it's helpful to look at the changes in our sex lives after childbirth, you know, in the context of all the other changes that go on as well. And yes, of course, having children is the single most dramatic change that a person can have in his or her life. It changes everything. So, yeah, of course it changes our sex lives. Now, that's not the only thing that changes our sex lives. But I think that one of the things that a lot of people don't talk enough about in this regard is that when you have children, it really positions you differently in the generational parade of human history. I mean, it's hard to think of yourself as a kid when you have children. It's hard to think of yourself as one of these days I'm going to grow up. So that, I think that collision, that existential challenge has a lot to do with what happens in people's lives after they have kids and what happens with them sexually. You know, all of a sudden you're having sex with somebody's mommy or somebody's daddy. In the best of all possible worlds, you know, that would be a turn-on, but in real life, it generally isn't.
Dr. Klein, one of your books is Ask Me Anything. Dr. Klein answers the sex questions you'd love to ask. I have one, and Jess has one for you. Most of our listeners are non-religious. I stopped going to church a long time ago, but when I was a young boy sitting in church, I knew I wasn't supposed to, so all I could think about was sex. That's all I would do during church is think about sex. Do you have any insight as to why that is?
Well, if you want to get somebody to do something, just tell them that they're not allowed to. That's the easiest way to get people. To get somebody to do something. Tell them that they're not allowed to, they're not smart enough to do it, they can't handle it, the thing that they want to do is dangerous or bad. That's the easiest way to get somebody to do something. So, you know, I think your experience is really typical. It's not unusual at all. The church, the Christian church in the Western world today, and even in the developing world, the Christian church is obsessed with sexuality. The Christian church, for the last 2,000 years, has been a religion that is absolutely centered around sexuality, more than any other modern religion today. And as a predictable result, you know, if you're involved in Christianity, you're involved with sexual obsession. The religious right, you know, these people are obsessed with sex. You know, I think about sex a lot. I write about it. I teach about it. I read about it. I do therapy about it. So I think about sex a lot, but I don't think about sex 24 hours a day, almost, but not quite. These people think about sex 24 hours a day. they walk down the street. And if they see two people holding hands, what you might see is an affectionate couple. What they see is sex. There's a commercial for tampons on television. What you might see is a commercial for a consumer product. What they see is sex. You watch an episode of a sitcom, and what you might see is two people who are having trouble making sense of their relationship. What they see is sex. They see sex. The Christian religion sees sex everywhere. And feels the need to control, channel, repress, focus sexuality wherever it goes. So, you put those two things together, the obsession with sexuality and the injunction, don't do it, don't think about it, don't have it, don't want it. You put those two things together, and it's an absolutely irresistible urge. I mean, if there were ever an engine to drive people to be hypersexual, it's Christianity.
Now, is it ever a good idea, in your professional opinion, to have a threesome?
I would never venture an opinion on a question like that. I mean, that's the kind of question that you ask people when you want to get them in trouble.
How about hypothetically? Does that help you out?
I wouldn't answer that hypothetical question. The question that I would answer is, you know, do I think that under some circumstances, some people could make a reasonable decision to do that? And the answer is yeah. And like any other sexual decision, in order to make a really good sexual decision, you have to have information. You have to know what it is that you want from the activity. You have to know what the other people want from the activity. You have to be willing. First, you have to understand the consequences. Then you have to be willing to accept the consequences. And to be perfectly honest, you know, heterosexual married intercourse, most people are not in a position to decide to do that, you know, using these criteria.
Right. I was going to say, it doesn't sound much different than any other relationship or sexual activity.
I think that people who are considering having a threesome, you know, ideally, they would use the exact same criteria that they would use, you know, in any other good sexual decision making. You know, do we want to hang from the chandeliers? Do we want to do it in the middle? Do we want to do it in the middle of, you know, Parliament Square? Do we want to do it, you know, while we've been drinking? Do we want to do it without birth control? I would hope that people would use the same good criteria for all sexual decision making.
I would say minus the birth control. The answer would be yes to all those questions. Dr. Marty Klein, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with us today.
Thanks, Marty.
Thank you very much for your excellent question.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney, and you're listening to Humanist Network News.
I'm your host, Jess Constantine.
And I'm your host, Duncan Crary. We were just listening to an interview with Dr. Marty Klein, a sex therapist and marriage counselor. Marty is the author of 6 books. His newest book is America's War on Sex. You can learn more about that at waronsex.com. You can also visit Marty's main site, sexed.org. And check out sexualintelligence.org. That's Marty's monthly blog or e-zine.
Marty speaks all over the place, so go check out his website for his next tour dates. Speaking of which, he'll be speaking at the Center for Inquiry West in L.A. this January 21st.
Our fellow humanist organization. So, Jess, I think it's time to hear some listener comments now. Of course, we here at Humanist Network News invite listener feedback. So,
hi, this is Ian McDaniel. I'm calling from Boise, Idaho. And I just wanted to let you know that I love the podcast, and I think that Jess and Duncan do an outstanding job. I'm curious to hear some more content on humanist ethics. I love the idea that good can be done for good's sake rather than for God's sake. And when I heard that the next show was going to be on sex, I thought, what a great opportunity. So, in particular, I'm curious to know how the Western view of sex became so evil and so dirty, how something beautiful can become nasty, and I suspect might be the humanist sexual ethic. So again, outstanding program, and thanks for a great podcast. Bye.
Ian, that's a great question. First of all, I would suggest buying a copy of Marty Klein's book, America's War on Sex, where he addresses this topic at much greater length. I was thinking about this just personally, and you know, it is curious that here in the United States, we still have this kind of lingering Victorian attitude about sex and sexuality, which for some reason, you know, most of Europe has moved beyond. You look at countries like in the Netherlands, where sex work is legal, and where sex workers actually, they have health insurance, and it's much safer over there.
And even closer to home, Canada, right?
Yes, up in Quebec, they actually have legalized a form of prostitution. It's still legal to be out on the street, and brothels are still legal. But yeah, that they have this more humanist, you know, approach to sexuality. So you're right, that is a Western, you know, the Western culture is it has pockets of very liberal humanist attitudes about sex. I think some of it has to do with the fact that so much of our Western culture was influenced by Judeo-Christian beliefs, which tend to be very patriarchal.
And very intolerant towards anything outside of their belief system,
mm-hmm.
and end up oppressing women mm-hmm. or homosexuals or...
Yeah. Well, you know, even the... Or you can look at some other cultures practicing female genital mutilation, forcing women to cover themselves in public. But you know, even here in the U.S., which is one of the most religious countries in the world, you have groups like the Promise Keepers. And some humanists are very critical of the Promise Keepers. Even though these guys are pledging to be faithful to their wives, you know, they're doing it in this Old Testament kind of patriarchal, demeaning way.
So what happens if the wives cheat on the men? They're not giving that pledge back to them? Is that how it works?
Well, it's I don't know how that works. I think it's just assumed that a woman would never cheat on a man.
Seems rather sexist, if you ask me.
Well, it is rather sexist. I don't know that. I don't know if the women are actually making the pledge, but who's next?
Hi, this is Ken. I'm a humanist in Indiana. You really are making humanism relevant to young folks. That's terrific for the movement, and I think you're doing a wonderful job. Please keep it up and take care. Bye-bye.
Thanks a lot, Ken. And speaking of young people, one of the ways that we reach the young people here at the Institute for Humanist Studies is through MySpace. And we've actually got a couple comments from some of our listeners that were left on our MySpace page. The first of which is from Daniel saying, "Hey there, just dropping by to say hello. Number 11 was great. It was interesting to hear Matt defend the Pope. I wonder if hell froze over. Anyway, looking forward to number 12. Keep it up."
And I received this one from TPO, and it says, "Thanks for the ad, Duncan." That's MySpace lingo. "You're doing a great job with the IHS podcast. You got skills, man."
Duncan paid him to write that. You should have seen the comment that Duncan left on his page.
Well, just how can people leave comments? Let's see. You can call us on our listener comment line at 206-339-4168.
You can also use our new Evoca recorder at humanistnetworknews.org and selecting contact HNN. All you have to do is hit the record button and start saying your message.
If you have a microphone, that is. Are you ready, people?
Hold on to your seats, folks.
Coming up next is an X-rated audio production directed by none other than Jess and me.
It's nothing that you haven't already seen Meg Ryan doing when Harry met Sally, though.
We really went out of our way for you folks to put together this presentation, but again, we warn you, if this kind of material, sexually explicit material, makes you uncomfortable, you can just hit stop right now and fast forward.
This radio play that we're doing is inspired by the old humanist joke. What is it, Duncan?
Oh, yeah. It's the old joke that people say about, you know, if atheists don't believe in God, then who do they talk to during sex? So we figured we would explore this topic using a screenplay provided to us by Jeff Swenson.
Humanists in Love, Deist on Top by Jeff Swenson, starring Lori Ellen and Carl Davis with a K.
Hello. What did we discuss about using the word God in the bedroom? I'm an atheist, and you know, I don't care to hear that name yelled while I'm making love.
Yes, but I'm a deist, and it doesn't bother me.
Come on, can't you think of something different to yell besides "Oh God"? Try words that embrace the natural world.
Seems to me you're being picky, but I'll try. Oh, oh yeah. Oh, I mean, oh, Mother Nature.
Mother Nature? That's the best you could come up with?
This isn't easy.
And now I have an image of a prune-faced hag with saggy tits stuck in my head.
What am I supposed to say?
I said the natural world, not mythology.
All right. Will you shut up before I go dry? Oh, Darwin. Oh, theory of natural selection. Oh, genetic drift.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Baby.
Oh, misunderstood, punctuated,
Oh, you're making me so hot.
Yes. Red Queen hypothesis. Plate tectonics. Radiometric dating. Oh, theory of cold fusion.
Say what?
Sorry. Heliocentrism. Macroevolution. Quantum physics. Einstein. Relativity.
That's better, you sexy thing.
Robert T. Baker. Stephen Jacob. Richard Dawkins. Richard Blakey.
Oh, yeah. I think I...
Johnson. Carl Sagan. Stephen fucking Hawking.
I think I'm...
Meanwhile, at the Discovery Institute Research Laboratory next door.
Jesus, what is going on over
I'm
there?
I'm coming,
Christ,
baby.
I think it's a new form of harassment. We better get our lawyers on this.
Hey, who was that really lusty speaker in the very beginning?
Well, thank you, Duncan. That was me.
I think you have a second career ahead of you.
Actually, that's what I used to do. Little did you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, I still, when they were rehearsing, I was in my office down the hallway. And even though I knew what was going on during that, it's still very unusual to be sitting in your office late at night hearing those sounds coming
from
imagine. Down the hall.
It was, I think it was equally embarrassing sitting here in front of the two of them acted out.
Yeah, they were getting into it.
They were. Now, for those of you out there who are listening to that, just so you know, that was my friend Lori Ellen, and she was faking several orgasms. I know it can be hard to tell if women, you know, are actually having an orgasm or if they're faking that. As believable as it sounds, was her faking several orgasms.
Now, that was here's the story. That screenplay was actually a cartoon that Jeff Swenson, free thunk cartoonist, drew. And it was inspired by a column that actually came to Maureen Matsumara, also known as Sweet Reason, our humanist advice columnist. Now, we spoke to both of them, so why don't we play some clips from Jeff Swenson first? Jeff got a lot of heat for that cartoon because it's got, you know, the depiction of cartoon anatomy.
You can tell that they were both very excited. In the cartoon.
Yeah, some women, though, one woman in particular, and then a few chimed in on this discussion board talking about the cartoon, were pretty upset about the female form. But let's hear what Jeff has to say to defend himself here.
Jeff Swenson, our listeners are very familiar with your cartooning because your work appears in our weekly e-zine, Humanist Network News. Jess and I are doing a whole show about sex, and we were just rereading one of your old cartoons called Humanists in Love, where you actually illustrate... one of our Sweet Reason advice columns about it's kind of a take on the old joke, what do atheists say during sex? It's a pretty explicit cartoon with a lot of cartoon nudity. And I remember you took a lot of heat for this cartoon on one discussion board in particular regarding your depiction of the female form. Can you recap what happened in that discussion?
Yeah, that was P.Z. Meyer's blog, Pharyngula. I think that's how you pronounce it. So basically everybody loved it, and then there was one woman who basically focused in on the physique that I had created for the woman, and I went off on a rant about extreme feminism, and of course I was probably wrong in doing that, and then she went off on, you know, how wrong I was, and everybody else, I think, saw what the problem was, and the problem was we were both wrong, and really nobody should have gotten upset because cartooning is just an exaggeration of the, you know, anatomy to begin with. So to get upset about the female anatomy drawn in the cartooning type form is, it just gets kind of ridiculous.
Well, Jeff, can you explain to our listeners, you know, how exactly do you typically create the female form in your cartoons?
Oddly enough, with this one, I did it kind of what I perceive to be sexy. I mean, I'm not the greatest anatomist to begin with. I mean, I'm a cartoonist. I'm not an artist. You know, cartooning is an exaggeration. So most of the females I do in my regular cartooning, they're usually fairly normal. Sometimes they're obese. Sometimes they're meant to be exaggerated so they look funny. I do the same thing to men. I mean, I treat men the same way. For this particular comic strip, I decided I should go sexy because it's supposed to be kind of like an adult strip. And originally, I didn't even mean to show nudity. I meant to show it in such heavy shadows that you really wouldn't be able to see much. But that didn't work out, and so it's no. Kind of monochromatic, and you get to see a decent amount.
Well, Jeff, a lot of your cartoons are a little risque, and I just wanted to know some of your thoughts on, you know, cartoons and pornography. Do you draw any cartoon pornography, by the way?
Yes, I do, under a different name.
Uh-huh.
Unfortunately, there's such a stigma about adult material that, you know, people find out and they suddenly have a different view about you as an artist or a cartoonist. It's just kind of bad for business in some respects.
Uh-huh.
You can easily find out, though, if you go across the web and just, you know, look around. You'll see, you know, if you compare styles, you'll find out.
Uh-huh.
But, yeah, there's such a stigma about adult material. The thing is, when I draw a lot of the stuff that, you know, maybe you consider risque or other people consider risque, I've been doing it for so long that it doesn't faze me. It's like, I went to art school. I drew naked people all the time because of a life drawing class. I went on to do a lot of cartooning that involved naked people. You know, I'm used to it. And it's like I get this culture shock for people who aren't used to it or who aren't involved in art or cartooning that involves that.
Mm-hmm. Well, do you think there's something psychological about, you know, adult cartoon pornography where you're sort of combining, you know, your childhood, you know, the Mickey Mouse cartoons, Donald Duck, you know, you're combining that concept with sex?
Yeah, that's why there's so many adult sites that do Disney parodies. It's absolutely true. I mean, there was a guy, I think his name was, I don't know if his name was Jab or something like that. He's well known on the web for doing parodies of Fred Flintstones having sex, The Simpsons having sex. I mean, I have the feeling that maybe it's just men or maybe it's both men and women. You know, we tend to go back to our childhood, and then we tend to, you know, have dirty minds about it. You know, we imagine what it's like for Marge Simpson to have sex with Homer Simpson, you know.
I don't want to think about that again next time I'm in a romantic situation, Jeff. Homer and Marge.
Well, you have to admit, she's kind of sexy with that hairdo.
Oh, yeah, she's sexy, but Homer. Ugh.
Well, nobody ever cares about the guy in a porno. I mean, as long as he's there.
Hey, he doesn't have to be there in my porn, I'll tell you that right now.
Yeah. All right, well, Jeff, thanks a lot, as always.
All right, thank you.
Take care.
Bye, guys.
Don't ask me why I'm crying. I'm not going to tell you what's wrong. I just got to sit on your lap for $5 a song. I want you to pay me for my beauty. I think it's only right.
Right, so that was Jeff Swenson, creator of the Free Thunk cartoon, trying to defend himself for his depiction of women in cartoons, and also revealing us a little something about his career.
Little known secret.
Now you all got to start there Googling, looking for some of Jeff's more risque work out there. I think he has a pseudonym though, right? So anyway, Jess, you were awfully quiet during that, weren't you?
I was. I have to admit that I had the same reaction as the woman who posted on the blog did. As like, why do I have to look at a woman that looks like this
uh-huh.
again somewhere else uh-huh. in yet another medium?
I just think it's funny. I have this. I mean, I understand where you're coming from. I hear. I think Jeff does too. I think he's, you know, revisited some of his ideas about you know, drawing women and cartooning. But I don't know. It just kind of reminds me of, like, you ever see Robert Crumb's cartoons? He's like an alternative cartoonist, Robert Crumb.
Yep.
It's just, he's got these really bizarre sexual fantasies that he just draws for you, and it's almost like voyeurism, or you're just sort of walking around through his subconscious. And, you know, when I see, like, Jeff's cartoons with these ridiculously drawn women, I just sort of feel like I'm looking at kind of Jeff poking fun of his own ridiculous sexual urges. What, I don't know. What do you think?
Right. Yeah, I was kind of going back and forth because I do, you know, it's his drawing and it is a cartoon.
Yeah, it's a cartoon.
And it's his fantasy. You know, I'm okay with not looking like the one that he fantasizes about because personally, I don't fantasize about him either, so.
Yeah. Well,
no offense, Jeff. I think that you do great work, though.
Yeah. You know, Jeff sometimes appears in his own cartoons, so you'll have to check out the way he draws himself.
Maybe I will.
Yeah. So, all right. Next up, Marlene Matsumara. She's also known as Sweet Reason, the humanist advice columnist. Her work appears in the weekly Humanist Network News e-zine. Marlene is a humanist, an activist, a writer, and a mother living in Berkeley, California. Marlene has had a very long tenure as a humanist, activist, and writer. Some, just some, of her roles in the Freethought community include serving on the advisory board of the Secular Student Alliance and on the Institute for Humanist Studies Grant Fund Committee, which awards more than $100,000 a year to humanist organizations and projects throughout the world.
Sweet Reason offers practical, empathetic, dogma-free advice for dealing with problems in the everyday lives of America's fastest-growing belief group, non-religious people. Published weekly by Humanist Network News, Sweet Reason uses compassion and common sense to help readers from around the world find their own answers to questions like, how do I break the news of my non-belief to my family? What should I do about the coworker who is trying to convert me to their faith? How do I get my in-laws to stop taking my kids to their church? Also tackles questions about life and other issues, whatever you might write to your newspaper's advice columnist, but always from the humanist viewpoint.
Oh, and don't forget she'll also answer questions like, what do I do with my atheist boyfriend who gets upset with me saying, oh God, during sex? We asked a lot of our H&N listeners to call in with questions for Marlene, Sweet Reason. So let's hear what she has to say. Marlene, you've been writing the Sweet Reason advice column for the Humanist Network News for almost 2 years now. Is that correct?
That's right. I started just before Thanksgiving 2 years ago. We wanted to get going for the holidays because we know that's a tough time for people.
Well, congratulations.
Now, I want to say, Marlene, personally, I'm not much of a reader. However, I do find myself, after looking at, you know, the comics and stuff, I definitely want to check out your advice column, and I actually read through it. And that's a big accomplishment for me, and that's a big compliment for you.
Well, thanks, Jess. I often turn to the comic page first myself, so I know it is a compliment.
Thank you.
Now, Marlene, we were just talking to Jeff Swenson, one of our cartoonists, about a cartoon he drew inspired by one of your columns, and it was involving a woman who was sleeping with a man who was an atheist who got upset with her for saying, oh God, during sex. That was one of my favorite Sweet Reason columns. Was it one of your favorites as well?
It was one of my most challenging. I'm with some of the people who read it who were trying to make sure the guy was for real. And I decided he was, and just figuring out how to empathize with what was on his mind was really a good effort for me.
Oh, I would say you always go the extra mile to give people advice for them and not just as a sounding board, so I really appreciate it.
This month, Marlene, we're doing a sex show. And in light of that, we have a listener comment that we're going to play right now for our listeners. And afterwards, could you give us some advice about her question?
I'd be glad to.
Hi, Sweet Reason. I'm Ophelia of Troy, New York, and I'm an atheist bisexual, which means, of course, I'm the fringe of the fringe. When I first came out to my dad as bisexual, he expressed his concern that I would never be happy or satisfied in a steady relationship. And at the time, I argued that if I were straight and in a heterosexual relationship, no one would assume that I'd stop being attracted to the opposite sex or that I couldn't be happy in a committed relationship. However, 13 years later, it's amazing it's been 13 years, I'm beginning to wonder if there weren't some wisdom in what he was saying. So my question is, do you think that there are two types of bisexual people, which is to say those to whom gender is invisible and those who can only be truly satisfied having relationships with men and women?
Well, I would say to Ophelia, to start with the same thing she said to her dad 12 years ago, I don't think this has something to do with your being bisexual. I think it has to do with how hard it is to find, for anyone to find the person they can commit to. It's the same if you were completely heterosexual or if you were completely lesbian. It just takes time. And sometimes that's scary. One thing you said about what you said about gender being invisible. No, it's never invisible to anyone. But I don't think that means that when you don't feel completely happy with a person, that the issue is necessarily gender. It might be an aspect of their personality that you think is, you know, if it's a man, that if he were a woman, he'd be different. But it's not necessarily so. And you're going to be happier in the long run if you just look at the person and see if they're the right person for you. One thing that I can tell you from 29 happy years of my own, that's working for my daughter who's copying me now, is that you can't always expect your life partner to be all in all for you. Sometimes you have to look for something elsewhere. If you like to go to rock concerts and he doesn't, go to a rock concert with a friend. But then come home to the person that you can count on and be there for them too.
Well, that sounds like excellent advice. Marlene, it's almost, we are in the holiday season as we speak. And I'm sure a lot of listeners have a lot of concerns and questions about how they should handle the holidays. Jess, I think we have a reader wrote in with a question for Sweet Reason about the holidays. Is that correct?
That's correct. I'm going to read it now. Okay, Marlene?
Okay.
Dear Sweet Reason, I just dread the coming holiday season as I struggle to be my authentic self. Instead, I'm faced with endless Merry Christmas, and when I respond with Happy Holidays, most people just don't understand or even hear what I say. How should I handle this? From Carol.
Well, the first thing I want to say, Carol, is just to hold out some hope for you. There are some parts of the country where everybody is saying Happy Holidays now, and there are major retail chains that are instructing their employees to say Happy Holidays. I guess the cynical way we could look at it is to say that all their customers' money is equally green. But anyway, they do want to make everyone feel included and welcome in their store. So if I would like to suggest that you not wait for something to happen, that for the long haul until your part of the world changes, you can work on making a change. Please think about writing a letter to the editor of your newspaper or an op-ed column. Make it upbeat. Make it the issue be inclusiveness of everyone, and suggest that the newspaper also cover different holiday traditions, as some do. And keep on saying Happy Holidays. Say it with a smile, and after a while, people will at least see the smile and smile back.
Sounds good, Marlene. Now, I have a similar question myself. It's more, how do I deal with my family wanting to celebrate Christmas, and particularly after going through a few years of some hardships and turning to faith, as often people do. But me, you know, turning away from faith and wanting to celebrate something more more humanist, or, you know, perhaps Kwanzaa or something like that. How do I make that transition with my actual family?
Here's the suggestion I want to make, Jess. Bring something to the family celebrations that represents your feelings and maybe some other people's. It could be maybe some evergreen boughs that are more of a solstice tradition. It could be a cake with a happy human drawn on it. I don't know what would work for you. But the idea would be not to quarrel with your family over what should happen on the holidays, but to make sure that the family includes everyone in the family. You know, at some point, maybe new members will be coming into your family that bring traditions of their own, and families can grow with that. My family now has a Hawaiian wing, and we're starting to include Hawaiian dishes in our traditional New Year's Day feast, and that's the kind of thing I have in mind.
Yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah, that is a great idea. I have a question along these lines, Marlene. It doesn't just deal with the holidays, but I'm very sensitive to it now. Obviously, I work for the Institute for Humanist Studies, and my job entails promoting the philosophy of humanism. They say that you're not supposed to mention religion, politics, or money at the dining room table. And whenever one of my relatives at a holiday asks me what I do for a living, you know, in order to answer the question, I'd have to get into all these issues. And it's not that I'm not proud of what I do. I just feel like every time I tell someone, you know, what I do for a living, they want to get involved in this huge conversation about religion, politics, and money. And I was wondering if you had any advice for me on how to tell someone what I do for a job, but not invite this huge conversation, especially not over the holiday dining room table.
Talk about the boring parts. Seriously. One thing people like to do when they're together as a family often is to vent, to unload, to talk about what's not quite right in their life, even on a holiday, and then have everybody cheer them up. There's got to be some part of your job that will not start a big conversation. It might be how boring it is to send 25 faxes when you've got a press release. I don't know. There's parts of your job that are unexciting.
Yeah.
So that's one thing. And another thing might be to just say, well, you know, I've got one of those jobs that you're not supposed to talk about at the dinner table. It could be fun leaving it to their imaginations. A third idea I have is to draw out somebody else before they can get started on you. And there's always someone at the table who's more quiet, and there's a way to bring them out of their shell without necessarily making them feel put on the spot, and it takes the spotlight off you.
Well, Marlene, thank you so much for your advice. I really had fun talking with you today.
Thanks so much, Marlene.
You've been doing some great work.
I appreciate it, and I hope I'll get to talk with you again. Bye-bye. Sorry for thinking that I knew what I was doing. I guess what I do best is look like I am in control. But tonight, I am a soft and untamed thing, and I will wrap my breath around you till your exhale comes clean. I am checking my pulse, yeah, checking my pulse, yeah.
You can read Marlene's column in our weekly e-zine at humanistnetworknews.org. Or for more information about Sweet Reason, visit her website, sweetreason.net. To say hello to Marlene, you can check her out on MySpace at myspace.com/sweetreason.
All right, next up we have a film review by Carolyn Bronius. Carolyn reviewed Short Bus, which is not rated, directed by John Cameron Mitchell.
Short Bus is an interesting, explorative, kinky trip. The film centers on the concept of relationships, particularly sex and relationships. Each character is on a journey to sexual self-discovery, and we're along for the ride, the entire ride. Jamie and Jamie are the central couple. They are two gay men thinking about opening their relationship up to other sexual partners and go to see a sex therapist, Sophia, to talk to her about it. In session, Jamie and Jamie find out that Sophia has never had an orgasm. They invite her out to Short Bus, a combination sex club and art theater for some sexual self-discovery. There, Sophia meets Severin, a lonely dominatrix slash artist who agrees to help her achieve orgasm. My initial reaction was that I liked the film. Everyone is talking about Short Bus and sex, while no one is really talking about Short Bus and the characters' relationships. Short Bus deals with the ins and outs of life, how it is easy and hard at the same time, how sex complicates things and is fun at the same time. There is a lot of sex in this film. Some people might consider it pornographic, but give the film a chance. American society spends a lot of time pretending people don't have sex. Heck, I even heard about the federal legislature proposing a bill on absence-only sex education for 21 to 29-year-olds. Please. There is one scene everyone is talking about, involving three gay men, the Star Spangled Banner, and a few anuses. People who focus on the scene are missing the point of the movie. Primarily, I'm guessing, because it is a lot closer to being involved in a long male three-way scene than a lot of us ever thought we could get. Honestly, though, I'd like to tell people to relax. If we all haven't done stupid or silly things while having sex or fooling around with someone or someone's, especially under the influence of alcohol, I think we are fooling ourselves. What struck me in the film, and that I haven't heard anyone really talking about, is the role of females in the film. Even though Sophia is one of the main characters, she feels almost like a fringe element at times. The lesbians have their own clubhouse in Short Bus, and Severin mostly hangs on the edges of the film as an observer. I believe this stems from the old adage of write what you know. The director, John Cameron Mitchell, being male and an LGBT actor, focused on writing about what he knew the most about, male relationships. My final sentiments for Short Bus are we see a lot of images of death, destruction, and violence on television and in the films, and no one gets up in arms about that. But put sex on the screen and people have a conniption. Short Bus by no means is an epic film of any kind. Instead, we get to watch some very good-looking people explore their personal sides, learn about love, and yes, have sex. There are worse ways to spend an afternoon. I just can't.
cannot believe I ever let you in here. And I'm so ashamed that I was ever so naive. And I just cannot believe I gave you so much.
That was Carolyn Branius reviewing the film Short Bus. You can read more of Carolyn Branius' film reviews in the Humanist Network News e-zine at humanistnetworknews.org. That is the weekly e-zine of the Institute for Humanist Studies, which makes programs like the Humanist Network News podcast possible.
Well, Duncan, that's our show. Folks out there, hope that you learned something.
Hope that radio play didn't scar you for life.
And I really hope that you weren't watching that at work.
Hey, now I can tell the difference between a fake orgasm and a real one, Jess.
Yeah, well, we'll see about that.
They all sound pretty good to me. The Humanist Network News podcast is made possible by the Institute for Humanist Studies, a nonprofit think tank that promotes the philosophy of humanism.
We'd love to hear your feedback on the show or perhaps your thoughts on non-religious sex ethics. So please call our listener comment line at 206-339-4168. One more time. That's 206-339-4168.
And you can also use the Evoca recorder on our website if you can figure it out.
Duncan, happy anniversary.
Hey, happy anniversary, Jess. That's right. This is our one-year anniversary for the Humanist Network News podcast. And we have a special treat to bring out the show with.
That's right. This is our Humanist Network News promo.
Yeah, it's a promo, about a five-minute promo that has clips from all of our shows pretty much from the last year. So enjoy. I'm your host, Duncan Crary.
And I'm Jess Constantine.
We'll see you next month.
This is Allison Bates, the campus organizer for the Secular Student Alliance.
Edward Jonsson, president of the Norwegian Humanist Association.
Michael Malik, board member with the New Orleans Secular Humanist Association.
This is Margaret Downey, president of the Atheist Alliance International. And you're listening to Humanist Network
Humanist
News.
Network
the Humanist Network News.
I ain't afraid of your Yahweh.
Duncan Crary.
And I'm Jess Constantine, and we're the hosts of Humanist Network News, a monthly podcast of the Institute for Humanist Studies. In each show, we try to explore a different area of humanist thought, from politics to pop culture.
Humanism is a non-religious philosophy based on reason and compassion.
In English, please, Duncan.
How about good people who don't believe in God?
You know, Brenda Fry actually said it really well on our show one time, Duncan.
She did. Our guest, Brenda Fry, the atheist who appeared on FX's reality TV show 30 Days.
One of the things that bothered Michael was the most was that he could not understand how people can live a valuable life and one that cares about the betterment of the world without having God or the Bible as a script.
Humanist Network News is an international program that's produced here at the Humanist Center in downtown Albany.
An international city, might I add.
A hub.
Albany, New York.
A melting pot. We speak with authors, activists, scientists, lobbyists, and youth leaders, such as the International Humanist and Ethical Youth Organization.
When I say the word humanism, what do you think about? Can I get one word from each of you?
No dogma.
Feeling connected.
The value of the human individual.
Human rights.
Democracy.
Humanism sounds like a pretty reasonable philosophy, right?
I think so.
Well, here's what humanists are up against in today's world.
We may be hinging maybe one vote away from losing church-state separation as we know it.
Theological definition of who can get married and who can't.
Industry cares about environmental, public health kind of things. Mm-hmm. And then on the other hand, the religious conservatives care about reproductive health and stem cells. The problem is you combine them together, it's kind of the perfect storm.
Other topics that we cover range from bioethics.
If technology be able to clone human beings, mm-hmm. would I consider those human beings different than those naturally conceived? Mm-hmm. Right. No, I wouldn't consider them different.
Right. To French gangster rap.
The argument made from the other perspective was, I am expressing a feeling which is out there on the street, and they're feeling this because of a combination of things, including economic impoverishment, police brutality, a sense of desperation about life.
Occasionally, our listeners also contribute essays, and they don't all have to be as serious as this one.
Jesus knew this and said to those gathered with him, "Eat me, okay?" Just eat me.
Sometimes we get lucky and interview celebrities like musician Holly Near.
And if you're working on racism, but you don't include gay people, then you only want freedom from racism for people who are heterosexuals? You know, I mean, you can't break us up into little pieces like that, much as people try. And I'm just unwilling to be chopped up into little pieces.
And here's Julia Sweeney from SNL talking about the atheist community.
The type of personality who's willing to say that they're an atheist is a person who doesn't mind being not aligned with the mainstream of society. And there are characters in this, but I love them. I love them. I mean, to me, these are my peeps.
And just to keep us on our toes, our listeners call in regularly to let us know how we're doing.
Heard the podcast regarding religion and superheroes. I'm wondering why Batman wasn't mentioned. Wouldn't he be a perfect humanist? Sort of scientific, clever, independent kind of guy without superpowers. Did it all on his own. So kudos to Batman.
Sometimes the staff of the Institute is asked to appear on other radio shows or podcasts, and we like to include those in our own show.
Joining us now is Matt Cherry, who's the executive director for the Institute for Humanist Studies. I find it interesting that your name comes up in an article that says, in defense of the Pope. From a humanist perspective, why get involved in this debate?
Because humanists believe in an open society where free speech is guaranteed for everyone, including people we disagree with, because it's really not free speech if you only allow speech for people you already support or agree with.
And I applaud that, because I'm a big fan of open debate.
And to give you a break from Duncan's constant rambling, I try to throw in some music that has either a social justice or activist twist to it.
I appreciate the facts why I'm here. Yes, I am a sound scientist. Came to evaluate the evidence.
To listen to our show, visit humaniststudies.org/podcast.
And don't forget to check us out on MySpace at myspace.com/humaniststudies.
I'm going to get you next show, Jess.
Yeah, whatever.